Good evening, and welcome to Vistra's second community meeting on the proposed energy storage facility at the retired Morro Bay Power Plant. My name is Brad Watson. I'm the Senior Director of Community Affairs at Vistra. I'll be the moderator for tonight's meeting. With me here in, at the front of the room are Mark McDaniels, Vice President of Renewables and Storage. Mark's responsible for the engineering, construction, and operations of Vistra's renewable assets. He lives in Beaumont, California. Make sure everybody knows who you are. David Yeager is Director of Project Development in California for Vistra. David is responsible for the proposed battery project here in Morro Bay, as well as those in Oakland, Moss Landing, and other opportunities that Vistra is considering in the state. David's been with Vistra 13 years, is a licensed professional engineer, and he lives in Santa Cruz. David? And also with us again tonight is Dr. Sherry Lebicki. Dr. Lebicki is a chemical engineer with a consulting firm of Ramble. All the presentations and reports presented tonight will be posted on our project website tomorrow, morrobayenergystorage.com. That's morrobayenergystorage.com. Here's our agenda for tonight. David will cover California's energy transition and the urgent need for energy storage in California. Mark addresses how Vistra operates our renewable energy facilities. And Dr. Lebicki will review again her offsite consequence analysis that was presented at our March meeting. That was the subject of a front page story in today's San Luis Obispo Tribune. You might have seen it. The OCA, as it's called, examines through computer simulation what would be the potential risks should there be a thermal runaway or fire event at the Morro Bay site. Then David will wrap up the formal presentations, offering some conceptual visions of the site under the master plan process that is being led by the city of Morro Bay. We will then have our question and answer period in our remaining time. Should there be any elected officials or staff members representing elected officials who'd like to speak tonight, please make sure that I know and I will call on you. Our meeting is being live streamed and we welcome those who are watching live with us tonight. It will also be archived for viewing later on slowspan.org. We'll wrap up our meeting about 8 o'clock tonight. I would now like to turn the presentation over to my colleagues, David Yeager, Mark Daniels, and Sherry Lebicki. David. We would ask that you hold your questions until the end, and then we will call on everyone who's asking a question tonight, if you would please. We will go till about 8 o'clock tonight. The sooner we get started and go through our presentation, the sooner we'll be able to get to questions. We'll go till 8 o'clock. We will try and get to questions as we can, and we want to be respectful for everyone's time. So presentation's probably going to run about 30 minutes or so. About 30 minutes. No, in total. Well, go ahead, David. Yeah, we'll get to questions later.
You check the mic. Thanks, guys. Can I get the presentation up here on the main screen? As Brad mentioned, my name's David. Great to see most of you guys again. For those that don't know me, David Yeager, Director of Project Development. And what I want to do is on the first slide, just kind of really kind of level set with where we're at, right? Why are we here, right? So there's three goals for the site in our proposal. So the first one is to reuse a portion of the site for the 24-acre BESS proposal, right? And we've talked about why reutilizing some of that infrastructure is beneficial for a ratepayer base, right? There's no incremental burden put on ratepayers by what we're proposing. So that's a key factor to keep in mind. The second part is the demolition and remediation of the stacks and the generation structure. So that goal is to remove those stacks and the structure from the site, right? So that unlocks that portion of the site. And then that leads to the third, which is improving the Embarcadero and Harborfront area. So with the site, the stacks and the generation building gone, the master planning efforts leading that view of what could go there, what's the future look like for that area, right? So just a quick timeline on the bottom. I'm sorry, if you can go back one. Plant was constructed in 1953. The plant retired in 2014, right? So I think most of you are aware of that. Vistra acquired the property in 2018 by way of merger with the company Dynegy that previously held it before Vistra. And then in 2020, Vistra submitted the redevelopment plan to Morro Bay. And then 2024 is the year that we envision the final EIR and all those pieces kind of concluding. So it's been a long process, a long history on that site. And as we go forward, that's kind of where we're at. And just diving a little bit further in regarding our application, I noted it was in 2020 when we filed it. So since then, in 2022, June, the environmental impact report was commissioned. So that's when it started. So it's been a long effort and robust effort to produce the draft EIR, which was published on March 11th. I'm sorry. So with that, that's kind of where we are. We're in the middle of this comment period tied to that draft EIR. And then that leads towards summer where the draft will become final. And then it will go to the planning commission and then city council ultimately, right? So that's kind of the plan for the path forward. So one clarification I just want to keep in mind as we go is, you know, what is the project? I want to define it for you guys. And that is those three kind of components that I mentioned earlier. So there's the 24-acre battery site. It's highlighted in the blue shape on the map there. So you can see that portion of the property. The second part is the demolition of the stacks and structures, right? And then, you know, that really unlocks that future development. So when those are gone, what can happen on that rest of the site is part of what the master plan is. And that's where that note says that any future development is guided by that master plan. That's where that kind of all evolves together. And importantly to note, too, just where we are today, the project has not been approved by the city. So there's not an approval, okay? You know, and even after the culmination of this process, there's still more process to go. And that's what's really important to understand, too. And I wanted to highlight tonight for you all is that further review by the city and the fire department, the city's consultant expert, the safety expert, and expert state agencies all have to be done before anything can be built. So there's still a lot more, even at the culmination of the CEQA process, as we call it, there's still substantial more work that has to happen with review by experts and state agencies in the city and the fire department. So I just want to make that very clear too. Okay, next slide. So on the land use side, I mentioned the master plan, right? And that's to set the stage for future development. It's a city-led effort, right? But Vistra's supporting it. And we're supporting it by way of funding. So the preparation of that master plan is ongoing, and it's the city effort, right? And really what it does, and the whole point of it, is to establish the vision for the future development of the rest of the site. So again, the removal of the stacks and generation building, the battery energy storage center on the 24-acre parcel to the side, and then what is going to happen with the rest of that property. And I mentioned CEQA. I use the acronym without defining it, but that's the California Environmental Quality Act. And that's important because it's required before the city can make a decision on Vistra's project, okay? And inside the CEQA, there's thorough consideration of the project's potential environmental impact. So that's the draft EIR. Right, that we've been is published, and in that EIR, it's over 18 topics, in each with subtopics. It's a very thorough document, very thorough. And again, this is a state required process. And inside that also is the feasible mitigation to avoid or minimize the significant impacts. That's in the draft EIR, and then also analysis of the alternatives. Right, that's also a part of it. And it's all a part of a transparent public process. We are in the middle of a comment period right now, so I'd encourage you all to make comments. That's exactly what it's for. All right, the next slide. So some may know some about Vistra, some may not. So I'm just going to kind of give you a quick rundown. So we're the nation's leading power company. We have the most megawatts, 41,000 megawatts. We've been doing this for over 140 years. Okay, so there's experience with our mission of safely and reliably producing electricity. That's the focus of the company. It has been for over 140 years. There's been a lot of different technologies over that time, right? So we're a leading company in the sense of revitalizing sites, changing technologies, being on the edge of new technologies. Let's talk about the grid's reliability for just real quick, okay? There are concerns about reliability. Reliability meaning, is the power on when you go to the light switch? Is it there? We all expect it to be. I do, right? And when it's not, it's a big problem. And we can talk about the inconvenience of that as a light switch. But during the hottest of days, which I'll go through, when air conditioners are required, if that air conditioner can't run, it's a threat to life as well. So it's very serious and a very important topic. The grid operators, have a lot to say about it too. They're concerned. The grid operators are the ones responsible for managing the supply and demand. So supply meaning the amount of power generation available. They're the ones that actually dictate who runs, which plants run, and they also forecast the demand. So they're watching all the power that we're using across the state of California, and then they dispatch their assets accordingly, right? Electricity works on a just-in-time basis, meaning it needs to be generated as it's being consumed. There's any excess gets lost unless there's a storage component, which is what the batteries are. So with that reliability part of the reason that it's kind of become more unreliable is this rapid change in the mix of generators in California. I really want to draw your attention to the yellow lines. These are a stack of the amount of power being put out by various different types of technologies. And you can see running back from 2011 all the way to 22, you can see the major increase in that yellow bar in particular. That's the solar, right? So since 2011, it's increased 20-fold in the state of California. Oh, go back one more real quick. Sorry. One other thing I wanted to note out too. There's a little green bar here too that represents the storage. And solar and storage go very well together. And you can see that the rush to the solar is being followed and tailed by the storage. And that's important. And I'll get to it in the next slide. So how the batteries work. During the day, when they charge, they're taking the excess solar. There's more than can be consumed in California during the heart of the day, and that gets stored in batteries. And then when that battery is fully charged, is holding that electricity for later in the day when everybody needs it. So then it puts it back out. And the next graph will kind of show it really well too. This is very busy, but I'm going to explain it. So each bar represents an hour of the day, right? So this is a daily demand the bars represent. So that means the amount of power that the state of California is using, okay? So you can see through the hours of the day, there's a natural peak in the evening hours, right? That's the peak load. And that is represented in the green bars. So you can see at the peak load, that's exactly when we drop in the solar production curve, that's the orange line, that's the amount of power solar is producing. You can see that it obviously produces when the sun's the highest and hottest, but the demand, the blue bars, aren't as high as the solar, right? So there's a gap. And that's that white space between the blue bars and the orange line is exactly what the batteries do. That's the excess power we talk about. So during the heart of the day, you can see that there's more solar being produced than the state needs, right? And then also during the peak, that's when solar drops off and is not available. So there's kind of a misalignment with that. And that's exactly what the batteries do. They capture that white space, and then they hold it to these evening hours when solar tapers off. And what they do is put it out. The demand still needs to be met, right? The state needs to balance that. Traditionally, they would dispatch a gas unit. So with batteries being able to put out power at that point, that would supplant any gas unit that would need to run to meet that demand, right? Okay, next slide, please. September 6th, 2022, this was the top demand day for the state of California, I mean, in its entire history. So the black line across the chart represents the peak demand of 52 gigawatts. That was the need of the state on that particular day. It was a huge heat wave, right? So the different colors represent different technologies producing power. So what I want to really draw your attention to is the solid black line just below the record peak demand text. That's that 52 gigawatts. If you stack up all these colors, You got the nuclear, you got the renewables, you got gas, you got imports, you got all these. That only gets you to the top of the solid blue or dark blue line. And if you notice, that's not enough to meet the demand. The demand was not met just with those resources. If you layer on the green color, that represents the batteries. So with the batteries that jumped on and were there, that was the one and only way that 52 gigawatts was met. So that's why that mix is very important. And at 4 p.m. on that day, this is an important graphic. That's when everybody's kind of getting home. You see the banking, you see laundry, you just see all these pieces. The batteries were producing in the state of California more than Diablo Canyon was. So just an interesting stat. One of the things, too, that Vistra is experiencing is revitalizing sites, right? And power plants are closing across the country, but the demand for electricity is growing. Electrification, EVs, cloud servers, all these things are increasing the demand. So with all the plants closing, there's a big impact to the mix, right? And that's what we're focused on. We're reusing and revitalizing land that's been used for the power, but in the least impactful way to the environment, and also contributes to the stability of the grid, which is what we just talked about, and also avoids the new ratepayer-funded transmission equipment. So this is reutilizing what's already been bought and paid for and is already maintained. You're not adding to the burden, right? That's the focus. And also importantly, it rebuilds the property tax base. These operating sites have a value on them, but when they're closed, they have a completely different value, and that's meaningful, right? So at Moss Landing, as an example, you know, we've, since 2018, what was on site was just a gas operating unit. We've spent, the company has spent over $1 billion installing batteries through that. And the payment to the tax payment to the city or the county there was $1.8 million in 2018. And then in 2024, we anticipate paying $10 million. So that $1 billion of investment to that property increased the tax payment from the 1.8 figure to $10 million figure. So that's Moss Landing. Okay. So I think that's it for me before I kick it over to Mark. So Mark, I'll just take it to you.
Thanks, David. And thanks, everyone, for coming out and spending your Wednesday evening with us tonight talking about this really exciting project we have here. So a little bit about me. Brad had mentioned that I'm Vice President of Renewables and Storage for Vistra, responsible for all engineering, construction, and operations of Vistra renewable assets. And so what that means is I take an advanced concept from David or other developers in our company and design it, build it, and run it. So I've been in the industry for over 40 years. You know, started out in the Navy as a Navy nuclear trained operator. I was 6 years on a nuclear powered submarine where I was operating the reactor. You know, last couple of years I've been at Vistra in this current position, and really enjoyed getting to know the company. But during the interview process, you typically go on the websites and kind of try to learn about the company. So, you know, they ask you questions during the interview, kind of, you at least know a little bit about the company. And so, was really, really impressed with the leadership and the generation mix, the types of nuclear, gas, coal, you know, all over the country, as Brad mentioned, or David mentioned, just a, you know, really important generating company for this country. But one of the things that stuck out most to me when I looked at the little map with dots all over it was there was a dot over Morro Bay. And so, you know, a little history about me. I was born and raised in Ventura. You know, my grandparents lived in Taft, and, you know, grandpa worked for Standard Oil his whole career. And, you know, like most people in Kern County, you know, to beat the heat, they would come over, you know, to the Central Coast. So, you know, starting in the 60s, you know, my grandparents had a cabin here, Morro Bay. And here's me, you know, with some of my prized possessions here. Some you can tell if you're reading from left to right, I got to be a little bit better fisherman over the years and practicing some of my moves on my surfboard before I head out to catch some waves there. So, you know, my grandparents were here, you know, till in Morro Bay till about the mid 70s when they moved over to Pismo, and they stayed there till they passed away about 10 years ago. So I have aunts and uncles and cousins in Cambria, Pismo, Oceano, and, you know, this, I just have significant ties to this area, you know, from coming here, you know, all the time. So really, really excited about this project, you know, from, you know, I think it's just as a power plant guy, I think it's a really neat project as far as technology goes. The location is fantastic. And certainly the need is there in the California grid. Again, been here my whole life. You know, have built several projects in the state, and I, you know, and I'm a consumer of electricity as well. So I understand, you know, the instability of the grid and the need that we have for some of these projects and battery storage. So, you know, next slide, you know, as I got to know Vistra as a company, as an employee, is, you know, really got to appreciate, you know, their approach, you know, to development of a project, you know, so, you know, in my past, I was worked for several different companies, utilities, you know, and, you know, independent power producers. You even worked for a hedge fund. And, you know, we talk about a more traditional developer of power plants or a private equity firm. You know, it's build it fast, cheap, and then sell it in a couple of years to try to make money out of it. And, you know, as I got to know Vistra as a, you know, during my research, but also as an employee, I became impressed with Vistra wants to hold these assets forever, you know, long past my retirement. You know, so there's no cutting corners on the design, you know, whether that's safety features, whether that's, you know, the components we use going into, you know, the interactions with the local community and taking input on design and emergency action plans. You know, again, the equipment we will buy, the employees that we train and hire. So, you know, we don't cut any corners because we want to keep these plants, you know, for the foreseeable future. So, you know, I have a few examples here of some of the neat projects that Vistra has completed here recently. You know, as David mentioned, and it comes up often because moss lighting, I think, is just it's very similar to the situation we have here with the Morro Bay plant as far as an old legacy gas plant that was shut down and torn down. And, you know, we replaced it with, you know, one of the larger battery installations in the world at Moss Landing. It's been a very successful project. De Cordova, you know, it's a little bit different as far as the Texas, the ERCOT, just like the Cal ISO is here, ERCOT is in Texas. So the needs of that market is a little bit different. So Vistra, knowing the market really well, we're a Texas company, so we know the needs of that market well. And, you know, put together this De Cordova gas peaker plant. And what it does is it's actually combustion turbines, but combustion turbines take anywhere from 10, 15, 20 minutes to get started. And so, you know, the need in Texas was they needed instantaneous response, whether it's voltage or frequency support on the grid. And so what the batteries do is that the batteries come on immediately and they support the grid while the gas turbine is starting up. So, you know, that battery situation there is a bit different than like a Moss Landing where it's, you know, it's more for 4 hour, you know, as David pointed out, you know, the afternoon, the peak when the, you know, demand is high, but solar's rolling off, you know, the batteries come in, we only need them for about 4 hours there from about 5 to 9 o'clock in the afternoon. Whereas in Texas, we needed that instantaneous response. So that's another way that Vistra studied the market and was successful in implementing De Cordova plant. Down in Illinois, we have a significant amount of activity in Illinois right now. Vistra has a number of coal plants, many of them still in operation, but some that are in retirement. So we're working closely with the state and the local communities to replace these coal plants with solar and battery storage. And so it's a really neat story, I think. You know, we're in there. You know, there's generation that was lost when the plants were shut down. So we're there to replace a portion of that generation. We're also there to increase the tax base and also employ some of the local folks. As you can imagine, it was a real hardship for some of these large facilities to shut down. And, you know, they had many people that worked at the plant, but then also the impact to all the mom and pop and you know, type shops and whether it's restaurants or maintenance shops, things like that around the community. So, you know, I think as we're right now, we're in the middle of construction on 4 plants there. There's probably another 20 plants to go. So really exciting area for us. So when you know, in my industry, when you talk about safety, one of the things that usually comes to mind is safety of our employees. and the, you know, the community around us. So that's obviously really important. We don't want to hurt an employee. We don't want to hurt a contractor that's in our plant working. We don't want to hurt anybody that's offsite. So, you know, but, you know, Vistra takes it, you know, a bit further than that, you know, as far as, you know, how we design and build the plants. You know, again, we want to hold these plants for the long term, you know, but, you know, we recognize that, you know, every project is unique and different, you know, so there's no one size fits all, you know, type of plant that we can just kind of cookie cutter and just put them in. We have to study, again, back to the De Cordova example, you know, study the needs of the local grid and, you know, the plant type and how it'll be used in the area. So, you know, back to the experienced developer and operator, again, you know, we've learned over 140 years of operating, you know, different types of plants across this country, you know, different fuel mixes. I think that, you know, we are probably the industry leader as far as, you know, operating these plants. You know, part of our design process is certainly to involve our, you know, our partners, you know, in the community, you know, the local first responders. That's very important to us. We work closely with them. I think a great example is up at Moss Landing. You know, we work closely with the local fire chief, Chief Mendoza there. I think that's a very successful relationship. And we really, really dig into, you know, their involvement from the very beginning. You know, that's something that they're along, you know, with us. They're reviewing the design. You know, we're implementing, you know, their comments and changes to the design of the plant, you know, based on their feedback. They're very much involved with, you know, the emergency action plans as we put those together. You know, they're in there on a regular basis as far as for regular training. You know, if there's changes to the plant, things like that, we're teaching them. We also have drills for them where we'll, you know, have like a mock emergency where they'll come on site and everybody plays, you know, plays the out this emergency just to make sure everything runs well. You know, all of that with the goal of making sure that, you know, in the unlikely event that there is an issue, you know, they're trained, they're well equipped, they know the site, and they know what to do when they get there. So again, all these things and many more feed into, you know, how we design our plants and really the three core principles for us as far as safety with prevention, detection, and mitigation. And so I want to dig into each one of those just a little bit. I know you're anxious to get questions, so I'll move along quickly. Certainly not going to read all these acronyms, but this is just a sample of the types of codes and standards and regulatory rules that we have to follow, in addition to the Vistra standards that we've generated ourselves with the help of independent engineers. As far as, you know, we take these codes and standards and we hand them to our design engineers, and that's where they build the plant to these codes and to our Vistra standards and guidelines. So, you know, part of the design process is that we, you know, we work with a contractor, a major, you know, engineering firm and construction firm to design it. Then that design is reviewed all along the way by my staff, the Vistra engineers. Then that goes to an owner's engineer that we pay for, who validates the design. They check every bit of the design that comes from our contractor after we've reviewed it. Then there's another step of an independent engineer that is employed by the lenders. If the project has project finance, they review and they have comments about the design. And then finally, it gets to the insurance engineers who have their review of our design, and they basically have a go, no go. And, you know, I don't know if it's made it up this way much, but, you know, there's an insurance crisis in Southern California where, you know, insurers are pulling out of homeowners insurance. And the homeowner is stuck not being able to get insurance, or their rates are doubled or tripled. And that's very similar to what we face. If insurers will not insure our projects, they won't get built. And so part of that process is the insurance engineer has final say on our design, the safety systems, the spacing of containers, the fire protection systems, the emergency action plans. All of that is reviewed by the engineer. So, you know, it's a very rigorous process, you know, that starts with some of the guidelines we have here. This is just a quick one to make sure that I don't think we've talked much about the containers. This is an example container. There's many, many different types of these on the market right now, and it's a really evolving field. We'll talk a bit about that more in just a sec. But yeah, I wanted to give you just a few examples about, you know, some of the regulations and codes and standards that were on the page before about how they're applied into the design of the battery containers. And, you know, these are applied everywhere. I mean, everything on site has codes and standards, whether it's wire connections, the way, you know, the beams that we drive into the ground to put the inverters on and the batteries on, all of that has codes and standards that we follow. But wanted to point out a couple of good ones, some active and passive pressure relief systems that are on the battery containers that, you know, in with experience and through testing, and there's been an incident in the industry where there has been a battery explosion, and the industry has learned that that's because pressure was not relieved. And so what we've done now, the National Fire Protection Association has mandated that these have both an active system to relieve pressure. So that means that, you know, one of these dampers, well, there will be a preset pressure inside the container, and it will automatically open to relieve that pressure. And if that does not relieve enough of the pressure, then you have the M dampers that just blow out. So it's basically just a little door that just flies open if the pressure gets too high. So, you know, these are just there's literally hundreds of these codes and standards and regulations that we have to follow, and that we have to build these to. And a bit more just, you know, about us, you know, as a developer and, you know, how we, you know, our approach to technology. And, you know, I'll be honest with you that in 40 years in this industry, I have never seen a time like now as far as evolution of you know, the products that we use, you know, gas turbines, steam turbines, nuclear plants, things like that. Those are legacy designs that have been around for a long, long time. And I'm seeing literally technology changes on a monthly basis. You know, there's projects that we would be looking at as far as an investment, maybe try to operate a project or either buy it or build it, and it wouldn't make sense. And then 6 months later, it does make sense because there's a new type of product that really fits the need of that niche application. So it's just really an amazing time. And, you know, sometimes it makes your head spin because it changes so quickly. So Vistra, as a company, we have a strategy division that their whole purpose is to be looking at new technology, making sure the company's informed on new technologies and how we can implement that technology. In my group, in engineering, you know, I have engineers that are specifically assigned to different components in the battery storage and solar programs, whether it's a solar panel, battery technology, inverters, all the major components that go into making these plants. They're studying this at all times. It includes going to China, Korea, over to Europe to go inspect these things. We go out to other sites. We go to the factories. We go everywhere just to try to stay ahead of this so that, you know, in the end, we can implement the most safe, reliable products and components at our plants. I wanted to get into really quick about, you know, how we are operating strategy at our plants. And so, you know, again, back to my private equity example, somebody that's in it for the cheap, you might drive by and see some containers sitting in a field and it's operated remotely by somebody that's in Ohio or Pennsylvania. We take a very different approach. We have operators stationed on site 24/7, so they're on rotating shift. They're at the site so they can walk out and physically inspect. They're on regular rounds that have to inspect the equipment. But our first line of defense is a very sophisticated control system that is literally looking at every single battery module in the plant all the time. And to give you an idea of what that task is like, just at Moss Landing, there's 250,000 battery modules just at Moss Landing. So that tells you that this system is bringing in a whole bunch of information. So the operators are watching the trends, and I just put up some mock trends up here to show you kind of how what they do. Everything functions in automatic. So, you know, Moss Landing here from the 60s and 70s, that might have had a couple hundred people out here opening valves and putting their hands on things and twisting them to get the plant up and down to start it, whereas these are fully automated. But the key feature on it is the safety functions. So, you know, in the old days, in a power plant, it might have been up to an operator to physically trip the plant if there was an abnormal situation. Now, with these sophisticated control systems, they're always monitoring it, and they're scanning these at millisecond rates. So it's literally at a millisecond rate. It can determine if there's a trend, if there's something going wrong, that will automatically trip the plant and shut it down. It'll electrically isolate it from the system and put it in a safe condition. All that can happen before an operator could even get his hand on a mouse and click to that screen. And I don't want to minimize the importance of the operators, because there's only so much you can do with technology. You still need somebody walking around, touching, smelling, seeing the equipment. So this is a very important part of it. So in addition to that, so that is at the power plant site. This here is our power operations center, which is located in Dallas. And this is where we staff with engineers that are looking at more long-term trends. So there's no operation happening here at the Power Operations Center. This is more sophisticated algorithms that we've worked with third parties and built that monitor long-term trends to make sure that, you know, something where an operator is looking at more at a minute, 5 minute, 30 minutes, end of a shift type of time frame, these people are looking at more at months and years of data to check and follow trends. Again, something that, you know, it might be so minute, it's changing so little over time that, you know, if you look at it every day, you wouldn't notice it, but these people do, and with the algorithms that we have there. So very important. I wanted to talk again about the MOS 2021 overheating incident. So, you know, this was not a thermal runaway. There was not a fire. It was an issue with some of the fire protection water connections that feed fire protection water to the modules. And this is an example. This isn't from MOS, but this is very similar. Each one of these boxes, this is a module. And like we discussed earlier, there's 250,000 of those modules at Moss Landing, so quite a few of them. And so each one of those, bless you, has fire protection water piped to each module of each of the 250,000. So that's a lot of connections. So coming out of construction, you know, the constructability was that you use quick disconnects, this little, you know, almost like your hose, you kind of click it together in the back. Well, you know, the batteries were functioning just fine. There was no issues with the batteries. There was smoke from an auxiliary piece of equipment that set off a fire alarm that put water to these connections, and some of those connections came apart and sprayed water on the batteries. So that was the MOS incident in 2021. So, you know, this company is great about implementing lessons learned about what we've learned over the 140 years of operation. And so we went back, you know, enhanced the system, enhanced the fire detection system, put some safeguards in place that would prevent this from happening ever again in the future. You know, we also, you know, we're really working closely with the regulatory agencies. I think that's something, what comes to mind is Senator Laird's SB 38 that really involves the safe design and operations of battery plants. We work closely with that office, you know, in drafting that legislation. And then just, you know, our continuous improvement culture in our company, just to always try to make things better. I wanted to kind of add to David's, David had kind of shown how things are working up above there. Just a couple of the major components here is the inverters. And, you know, it's not a direct comparison, but if you think about an inverter, think about you know, you're charging batteries in your house and you plug it into the AC and the wall, that takes the alternating current, turns it into direct current to charge the battery. You know, the twist with a battery storage plant like this is that it charges the battery, but then it'll also flip it around and allow turn the DC from the battery into alternating current to put it back on the grid. So that's what's happening with the battery. And here's here's one of the drawings here that kind of shows the interconnection. So all of these are wired. These are all battery containers in each one. And these are the inverters, the dark lighter brown. These go to a collecting station, and then those go to the substation for the facility. And this is where it physically connects to the grid. So when the batteries are discharging, the electricity is going out to the grid, and then when they're charging, the battery goes into the inverters and then charges the batteries. Thank you very much for your attention. I'm sorry I was kind of speed talking. I wanted to, you know, keep my time to a minimum, but thank you.
Thanks, and thanks for letting me talk to you. For those of you who were here last time, this is going to be a little bit of a repeat, so for that I apologize, and I'll try to make it relatively quick.
Pardon me, but would you please put down the signs for courtesy and civility for everyone here, but especially for those who are watching online? Thank you. Go ahead, Doc.
Next slide. Next slide. Can I have the next slide? Yes. And the one after that, too. I'll just go through it. So Granbull, this is a company I work for. Oh. Granbull's founded in 1945 in Denmark. We're a Danish engineering firm. We're a worldwide firm. Some of the expertise that went into this study actually came from Sweden, where we have a battery expert that we were working with on this particular. This is me. I'm a chemical engineer by training. I've done a lot of air work. I do work for public entities in addition to companies, including California Resources Board, two air districts, the city of Richmond. I work with them to regulate the Richmond refinery. So the purpose in the big picture, you heard the safety evaluation, and one hopes that the safety procedures are sufficient, that there will not be an event, there will not be a fire, but if there's a fire, this is what is done to evaluate what would be the impacts of that fire. You know, lithium ion batteries are everywhere. I drive a Bolt. I have one in my garage. But emergency response plans are required for facilities like the one that's proposed here. And government agencies have decades of experience managing risks. So the way that we do the risk evaluation for this battery system is similar to the way we do risk evaluations for refineries and everything else that has potential dangers for the community. And I just do want to point out that BESS facilities have been cited in urban environments from a safety point of view. Go ahead. That I don't know, but I can certainly check. So what's an offsite consequence analysis? This is what we did. It's 65 plus pages. We did a thorough literature review, and I'll talk a little bit about where the emissions came from. Hundreds of computer simulations. The report, if you've seen it, has 100 plus scientific references. It is available to the public. And the conclusion is no significant risk to the community. And I want to talk about how we got there. In particular, there are conservative assumptions to overpredict potential impacts to the community. And we'll talk about those as well. These are based on EPA recommended models. And this is an approach that is used to inform siting of various industries. Go ahead. And this is what I call a kind of a safety circle. And the OCAs actually inform the entire safety circle with basically on the prevention side is the prevention, the mitigation, and the preparedness side. And the preparedness side is actually what we're going to be talking about here. And the OCAs can also be used to improve overall safety and risk because they can point out where there might be issues. Go ahead. The basic of the OCAs that were done here is these are done pursuant to guidance documents that are released in terms of how to do these. And the OCA analyzes the maximum credible release event. That's what it's designed to do over a given time frame. And there are various conservative assumptions along the way, and I'll walk through those with you, that are designed specifically to make sure that the analysis that we're doing is conservative. That is to say it overpredicts impacts. Go ahead. I'm sorry, offsite consequence analysis. Thanks so much for that. And the point of the offsite consequence analysis is actually to evaluate the entire community, right? What could happen anywhere in the entire community as a result of some kind of release? Go ahead. So we'll talk through what a release looks like. It's a thermal event starts at the facility. The thermal event causes some battery components to burn. The burning components release gases, and the gas from the release can blow towards people. And that's what this analyzes. It analyzes that the released gases blow towards people. Go ahead. And when we talk about evaluating risk, I'm just doing the red side of the equation. I'm not doing the other side of the equation, which says, how likely is this, right? I'm just saying, let's say the worst case happens. And so we're looking at the hazard and scenario selection, the consequence modeling, how much is released, the consequence evaluation, where does it go? And then the risk control measures and mitigation plan. What do we need to do to make this a safer facility? And I do want to point out that the likelihood of all of these all of these events happening at once, and we'll go through how we do this conservatively is slim. Go ahead. And so what are we looking at in terms of the chemical release? We have reviewed lots of studies that evaluate emissions from battery fires. And most chemicals that emit are emitted from battery fire are flammable, but not toxic. However, hydrogen fluoride is unique to battery systems, among other fires. So if you have a couch on fire, for example, it emits all sorts of chemicals, but not hydrogen fluoride. And because hydrogen fluoride is a major component of the battery risk, we evaluated that, and I'm going to talk about it in this slideshow. However, the report itself also evaluates four other chemicals. So the fact that I'm talking about just hydrogen fluoride here does not mean we didn't look at other chemicals as well. So go ahead. So how much is released? There is extensive literature in the battery world about fires and the chemicals that are released. And we took all of that literature and we're basically able to create what we call an emission factor. And the emission factor says how much is released per weight burned. So how many milligrams of something is released per kilogram of battery burned? Those emission factors vary substantially. And we took the highest emission factor that had support in the literature. So we looked throughout the literature, and for each chemical that we evaluated, we took the highest emission rate. This is all laid out in the report. Every emission factor we looked at is laid out in the report. So go ahead, next. So how do we assess the impact? There are two agencies that evaluate impacts on individuals. That's the EPA and the AIGCH. It's basically the Association of Industrial Hygienists. They came up with two types of thresholds. They're quite similar, and you'll see that. One is the Emergency Response Planning Guidelines. The other is the Acute Exposure Guideline Levels. So we call these the AGLs. Some have time, they all have exposure times associated with it. If we go to the next slide, you can see that the ERPGs just have one time frame associated with it. That's an hour time frame. The AGLs actually have a 10-minute time frame, a 30-minute time frame, a 60-minute time frame, and an 8-hour time frame. And if you look to the left, you'll see that as the time frame gets longer, the allowable exposure gets less, and that makes sense, right? You could take a quick whiff of something and be relatively safe, but if you're exposed to it for 8 hours, you need a lower concentration. So what do we do to estimate downwind concentrations? We use simulations that mimic the chemistry and physics of chemicals moving in the air. And these are government models, and the particular model that we use is called AirScreen. And that model is designed to show a maximum potential concentration for any kind of meteorological condition. Go ahead. Now, these are two wind roses that represent what's going on in Morro Bay. Neither of these wind roses were actually used in the analysis, because in the analysis, we assume that the winds are always going right from the fire to the nearest resident. So we ignore the fact that the winds actually typically don't go from the location of the battery to the nearest resident. We always assume the winds are going directly from the location to the nearest resident. But we put up the predominant winds just to give you a sense of what they look like. Go ahead. So these are the predominant winds again. This is the distance to the nearest receptor. This is the enclosures alternative. And you can see the nearest receptor is 443 feet to the northwest. And you can see where the other receptors are too from the location, from the enclosures. And go ahead to the next one. And this is the distance to the nearest receptors from the proposed project. It's a little bit different because they're located slightly differently. Again, the winds are not, you know, exactly blowing for the most part to the nearest receptors, but that's what we assume for the analysis. So go ahead. So we assume slow wind speeds, and I want to put a caveat on this. For one of the scenarios that we worked on, the slowest wind speeds weren't the worst. And when we did the analysis, we used the worst wind speed for that scenario. But for the most part, the government thinks that the slowest wind speeds are the worst. We didn't make that assumption. We tested all of the wind speeds. We assume the winds are blowing towards the residents. We evaluate the impact at the nearest residence. We use the maximum emission factors like I talked about before, maximum credible fire event, and health protective standards in order to look at what the impacts might be. Go ahead. And these results are shown in blue for the enclosure alternative, green for the proposed project alternative, for the most impacted residents, for these various time periods, the impacts were always below the threshold. And what does that mean in terms of its ability to go off site? Go ahead. These are maps showing the various exposure areas where there might be an exposure above a threshold and it does not go off site. And you can see the little blow up here. And that's for the enclosures alternative, next for the, did I skip a slide? Enclosure alternative, go back up. Go ahead, go on down. So how do we interpret the data? There's extensive modeling to identify the reasonable worst case conditions. The model scenarios, and this is important, over-impact the impacts of real-world events. The model fire size is unlikely. The 24-hour duration is unlikely. Receptors are always, in other words, we always blow to the potential receptor. It's unlikely. For the longer time periods, EPA uses very conservative persistence factors to assume that the wind mostly keeps blowing towards the receptors. The real-world impacts would be lower with a smaller fire, a shorter fire duration, typical wind directions and speeds, typical emergency response, so it wouldn't go on for a long period of time, and wetter weather conditions. And when we think about the impacts of events, there's two things we look at. One is the probability, and the other is the impact. This just analyzed the impact. It didn't look at the probability because the impacts are considered to be insignificant. It's below a threshold of concern. So even if the event likelihood were moderate, it's a low potential for impact because the impacts are not significant.
Okay, I'll wrap up our presentation. I know I'm between everybody and questions, so I'll go really, really quick through this. A couple of just key points to wrap up as soon as the presentation is back in the next slide. I think I showed this map to most of you guys last time, but this map is the transmission map of this local area. And what's really important is that Morro Bay is situated in a very unique position on the transmission grid. And just to reiterate too, generation has to be located across the grid. It can't be in one location. There are losses that occur when you do transmit electricity long ways. So it is very important, as the grid's designed currently, to have generation scattered along it, right? So it's very important. And then the next slide. A couple key things too is that because of this network that's already built in Morro Bay, that's the no incremental burden to ratepayers, right? So the transmission's already in place. That's a very key part, and it's underutilized in its current state. So, new lines, if you were to talk, let's put some more blue lines on the map. It's a decades-long process, right? So that's where repurposing the existing grid as designed is exactly what's happening across the industry. The plants originally were built across the coast, right? So that's where the trunk line is, and that's where the proposed project's also planning to be. Next slide. We talked about these three goals, so we can just kind of go into each. It's okay. You can just go to the next one. So, the ratepayer first, this is just an aerial image. Mark kind of had the same one too, but you can see the enclosures on the 24-acre parcel. You can see the stacks and structure gone. So that's the other part, right? And then the master planning that's going to guide the rest of the development. So here's some aspirations and ideas. So once the stack and structures are gone, what can happen with the rest of the site? It opens up that area of the property for future redevelopment. So here's just some aspiration. There's Lila Kaiser Park. Here's just some opportunity. You can see, just give you a gauge on the space that's available generally. And this, again, these are just aspirations. The master planning part's going to govern or guide this. But just to give you a visual of what's possible down there, here's a sense of that. Further too, and again, the master planning component, that's what's really guiding the future of the development here. But after the stacks are gone too, here's a view of the Embarcadero and kind of harbor front of what could potentially occur once the battery's built, once the stacks are and structure are demolished, and that master planning is complete, to where that's really guiding the rest of the way and revitalizing this area potentially. Here's another important piece too. So right now, the project expense or cost that we plan to invest is around $900 million, okay? So what that means locally is that with that invested, this is similar to the Moss Landing slide I had up earlier, it unlocks about a $9.9 million property tax payment from Vistra to the county, right? That's where it goes first. During construction of that $900 million investment, there's local sales tax that's applied to that, right? So there's a one-time kind of stimulus or payment or you know, really it's a stimulus from that construction phase. So that's a lot of money being spent locally in a short amount of time, and all that sales tax would flow through. And then again, just can't reiterate enough, it just reuses the existing ratepayer funded transmission to help. That's a very, very important piece. That's not that's a very unique thing to this development. So with that $9.9 million payment in the current tax structure, what that ultimately accounts for is a $1.3 million annual payment to Morro Bay itself. So that's where the 9.9 goes to the county, then it's distributed from there, right? So that's where the estimate is at this current time. And that's an ongoing annual payment of $1.3 million. And that's the annual payment in year number one. You know, the draft EIR, the alternative to this is the enclosure, showing more and more renderings of this just to kind of help understand. I think we're all understanding the building concept, but this is where we want to make sure this is understood. And we're exploring the alternatives in the EIR, right? And, you know, the commercially available products are evolving. We're constantly watching that as Mark's laid out. The best available technology will be chosen when it's time to choose the technology. So that's where there's no decision yet. So that's later in the process, right? And one thing I do want to note too, and we can keep going. Let's go to the next one. So really the aesthetics is what the comparison of the two options is. Just want to just kind of lay out a similar view just for information purposes. You have the building option and then the container option. And just to note, the berm is 33 foot high out there, and the containers are about 15 foot tall. So from the backside, like at Morro Rock, if you're looking at the property, it's completely screened. You wouldn't see anything, okay? So that's part of the view too. And ultimately, I want to be very clear too, like in the draft EIR, these alternatives are in there. It's ultimately up to the city as to which direction this goes. This isn't a Vistra decision, right? This is an accumulation of information, studying the different alternatives, providing different information on either or, but ultimately the city gets to decide which direction this goes. And then, you know, the summary of the draft EIR, I think at this point it's kind of been communicated, but just to reiterate, really there's no significant impact tied to the battery itself. The significant impact is on the demolition. And you can see the unavoidable historical resource with the demolition of the buildings and the structures. That's the one noted unavoidable impact, right? So all the others tied to the BESS and otherwise are completely non-significant. And that's just taken from the website. So with that, we're done. Ready for questions. Brad.
Okay, thank you very much, team. I appreciate that very much. Another reminder that all the presentations and the reports tonight will be on the project website tomorrow, morrobayenergystorage.com. We're now going to start taking questions and comments. As we put out in the news releases announcing these meetings, we've asked people to go to our website to submit questions. Some have. We'll get to those questions and we'll start taking them from the floor. All you need to do is raise your hand, and I will do my best to try to pick the people who want to ask questions and be fair and broad about it. So we're trying to cover all of the sections of the seating. One question we've had that has come up online several times, and let me do my best to head that off early on as we open it up for questions and comments, is that we keep hearing about our energy storage project is somehow connected to the Morro Bay wind energy area. that is also being studied, or with the three companies selected during the lease bidding. And Vistra would like to make it very declarative and very clear that our proposed battery project has nothing to do with the wind project or the companies involved. We have nothing to do. Our project could be built and operate irrespective of what happens to the wind energy project that's ongoing. Let's see. We'll take one here. One that came in from John Flaherty from the website. Will the proposed battery storage facility have any impact on the water in Morro Bay? If there's a fire at the facility, is there a chance any materials used to suppress the fire will drain into the bay?
I'll take that one. So fire water and the response water is housed on site already in tanks. That's the plan. So it'll have water already ready to go. If that water is used for whatever reason, right, it's contained on site. It will be contained. It's tested. We have discharge permits that we would have to abide by, right? So, and that this is similar to our Moss Landing facility, to where when water is discharged, it's captured, it's held, it's tested. It needs to be tested according to the standards before it can be released per our permits. So all those things will occur, Brad.
Okay, we're going to start taking questions from the floor now. And we have two of our staff who have microphones. And so when you're called on, they're going to come to you. And you can address the microphone so people here can hear, but also our viewers watching online can hear as well. And I'll try and think ahead to pick some folks along the way so we can anticipate the next question. We'll start with the front row. Go ahead right here. Wait till we get our staff person up here. So hold on just a moment. Okay, here we go. Go ahead. And you might stand if you'd like. It's
on. The Vistra company. Hi. If the Vistra company has nothing to do with the wind farm, what energy are you planning on storing the...
In the batteries?
Yeah.
Okay, very good question.
But I'll take that one. That's a great question. And I'll stand to you guys. So I tried to illustrate that through the chart that I showed. So during the peak of the day when the battery's charged is when there's an excess of solar being produced in the state. So it's tied to the grid, right? So the grid being the network that's congregating all electrons from all producing assets, right? So but during the heart of the day, there's so much solar that's being produced up and above and beyond what people need. That's where the batteries kick on and absorb that, and then they hold it until later in the day. So it's tied to the grid, and it puts it right back out to the grid. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do we have a question here in the middle section? How about right back here? Right there. Yes. Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Have there been studies regarding impacts of unplanned hazardous chemical release on our local wildlife species? And if not, why not?
So to be clear, you're talking about like air releases like from the batteries. So it's a great question. And these ecological studies, offsite consequence analysis, are in their infancy in terms of their ability to do things. And it's primarily because people don't understand, you know, for each species, right? For humans, you think, oh, there's all these studies to figure out what does hydrogen fluoride do for people. And you can imagine how much more difficult it is to look at all the various species and try to figure out what, you know, what the hydrogen fluoride is doing for them. So the short answer is no, and the slightly longer answer is we just don't have the data.
And I might add on to that's the air discussion, like the air component. So if there's a chemical like fluid release or whatever, that's what I was talking about. It the sites are designed that anything that's released on site is contained. It's not just off the property. And then it's held there, then either disposed of or properly taken care of, or it's tested according to the permits at a level that can then be discharged. So from any other, you know, aspect, that's the how these operate.
Our left section. Any questions over there for the moment? Oh, got one. Caroline.
Do you have a pen? You can write these down. I have several.
Well, I know that many of you have several questions. We'll take two, because we want to try to get to.
Will you come back to me then?
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. We'll do our very best to get back to you.
Thank you. If the city turns, oh, by the way, hat tip to the Navy nuke there. If the city turns you down, will you commit not to sue the city? That's the first question. And then the second one, there's in your EIR, which I've been reading, it's very painful. But there's no serious discussion of alternate locations. I mean, your discussions are all focused here. If you put it somewhere away from a population center, you reduce the risk to the city. And I'm sorry, one more, if I may. You talk about this being the great spot and the sweet spot and all this. All that is code for it cost us less to put it here. Okay? But we still take the risk for your less cost. That's all.
All right. First question. Vistra's commitment since 2020, when the permit applications were filed, is that we want to partner with the city of Morro Bay. And that is true today as well. We want to partner with the city on that project. So that's what we're focused on. We understand there are other options available. We're not thinking about them and the necessity of them at this time at all. You had a question about litigation. We wouldn't even entertain that. We're not there yet. What's on the table is the applications that we have submitted. We're going through the draft EIR and CEQA process. And you know, our commitment is enduring to do this with the city of Morro Bay. Now, the second question was about location, David?
Yeah, and specifically in the draft EIR, right? This location there. So the EIR was a city-run report. So Vistra didn't do that. Like, we didn't do the study. So the city of Morro Bay did the study to do these things. And there's guidelines on that. And what's really critical, if you have a concern, like what you're saying now, is that during the public comment period, which we're in the middle of, it's a great time to opine or discuss things that you think might be missing or not looked at or improperly looked at or whatever, you know, option you might think of. It's a great time to put that comment in. That's great. No, don't send it to me, please. It won't go anywhere. Take it to the city. Oh yeah. I will happily read it, but if you want action on it, don't give it to me. Okay. So please go to the city. And I'm sorry, city people, for like directing, but that's how the process is run. Is the city, it's the city's report. They published it. Any comments on that needs to go back to the city. So then before it goes final, all these pieces are incorporated and considered. Right. And that goes with any comment related to the EIR.
Okay. Let's go back over here. Yeah. Go ahead right here, please.
All right. In March, I was happy to note that you said the Department of Army called the BESS plant critical infrastructure. So I went back to look and see why the Department of Army was worried about it. On page 7 of this document, it's terrorism. They say critical infrastructure is a major terrorist target. So I went to the National Terrorism Advisory Board. The United States remains in a heightened threat environment. Likely targets of potential violence include U.S. critical infrastructure. So then I went to Vistra's SEC filing, and it warns about how people can die in, they have several different things here that they say. Operation of power facilities involves significant risks and hazard. These and other hazards can cause significant personal injury or loss of life and severe damage to the environment. In your SEC filing, you mentioned terrorist activity on 5 different occasions. You also mentioned fire. When I look at your other BESS plants, they're out in the middle of nowhere. Morro Bay has 18 full-time police officers. It has 11 full-time firemen. So here's my question that I want answered. Knowing all of this and the fact that your proposed BESS facility will be built in the heart of the tourist area and near a high school, knowing that there are other sites that BESS can be built, Button Willow in the middle of nowhere, I've been told, has all the power infrastructure. How can Vistra, in good conscience, build a facility that will put our community at risk of loss of life and livelihood from terrorism?
Brad, I'll take that one. Right. I'll take that one. Yeah, no, Rachel, good question. No, thank you for asking that. So Just a couple notes. The PG&E switchyard currently that's been operating is critical infrastructure already. So that critical infrastructure is in town. It's active. There's power that flows through it every single day.
It is active. There is electricity flowing through it right now.
I'm not trying to debate you right now. Power flows through that substation every single day from the grid. So the grid is connected. It's a big network. It goes through that power plant every day. When a substation is active, PG&E has maintenance standards that they abide by, and it's governed. It's required. There's no other way around it. So just to dispel any type of confusion around that, it is active. It's not dormant. So that critical infrastructure is already in place currently. Thank you for that. So when we talk about the grid as a whole, and when we highlighted the need for more power, that's not a mutually exclusive discussion overall in the industry. It's not either or. It's all suitable locations are needed to support the need, right? So Morro Bay being evaluated as one of them for sure, but just because another one does exist doesn't necessarily mean that it needs to forego this opportunity as well. Does that make sense? That doesn't make sense?
Well, let me back up. We covered this the last time in the meeting, and we went through that, yes, we have going on 60 power plants, and they're all considered critical infrastructure by the Department of Homeland Security for obvious reasons. We have relationships with federal agencies, which we articulated, FBI in particular, DHS, the state. But when it gets down to it, it is the authority having jurisdiction, which would be the Morro Bay Police Department, which would be the lead agency that would be working with us to establish security at the site for all forms of threats. They think expansively in this world, and we all know why. So we look at and work with them, with our corporate security people, to address these issues and what it takes to do that. So as David said, there's already critical infrastructure down there. Now, regarding the safety of the facility, Dr. Lubicki's report has established that already in 79 pages. I hope you go online and read it all, plus the PowerPoints from tonight and from the previous, which establishes that it is a safe facility. There are safe battery storage projects being built throughout California at more than 100 sites in this state. There's more than 5,000 megawatts. There are, right now, facilities in populated areas. In Goleta, there was an 86-megawatt storage facility that just opened. 86 megawatts that's next to a brewery, an apartment complex, Arterial Highway. In Menifee, there's 680 megawatts being built that is within 2,000 feet of residential areas. The city is supportive of that project because they have looked at the plans, they have looked at the safety factors, they look at the safety design built in, and have approved these projects and are supporting them. These are safe projects. They are going to be addressed for security purposes.
Hey, Brad, this is Patrick. We're getting some chatter back here. So yeah. What I think would help Dr. Lubicki, you're a chemist. And the concern is, would a terrorist, you can't speak to a terrorist intent, but these batteries are here. So if someone were to come, can you walk through what is in the batteries? Because it's in your report about the release. Or other people may be concerned, would they daisy chain and explode? We've seen that all be talked about online. You are our expert tonight. From what I'm hearing back here, I think they're thinking the question hasn't been answered. Do you mind?
Yeah, so let me make sure I get what people are concerned with. I don't have a sense of what a potential terrorist attack can be, but I can say that the batteries are designed, they have passive design, and maybe David, you can really do that, to basically slow any propagation. And the way that we did the fire is we did the fire at a rate that was, I just want to get this right, something like 10 times higher than the propagation rate you would expect based on the safety measures, just to be, again, overly conservative.
Yeah, and I can add on to that a little bit too. So when we talk about explosion or, you know, a big violent event, when the issue with batteries, they don't spontaneously just blow up on their own, right? They emit gases when it goes into thermal runaway. And then if those gases that they're emitting are contained or trapped and they reach a certain density, that's the concern. So that's where venting and all the different components that Mark kind of walked through, that's why those are there, is to prevent those gases from ever kind of, you know, accumulating to a level that could have that violent of a reaction. So all in the design itself, it mitigates that type of an explosion, right? So that's where the overheating is the concern with the batteries, not necessarily an explosion. That's more of a secondary concern.
Let's get to the middle section for a question here. You want to try this gentleman right here?
Yes, I have a question about, I guess it kind of ties into a little bit of what we're talking about. So this is touted as the world's largest battery storage facility. And I get it, you know, why, you know, you want to be here. But also, doesn't it seem that having smaller facilities in strategic locations would be a better option? I know, besides the financial option here, but what everybody sees, doesn't it seem to make sense to string a series of places of battery storage where they're actually making it, like, you know, out in 41, 46, where they're having big solar facilities out there where they're producing the energy? It would also seems like a way to the future to have these, even for terrorist locations like they were just talking about, and mass shootings and everything else. They seems like nobody wants to get into these big crowds, and if you have a big storage facility or a big plant where you're making electricity or anything, seems like a big target. So, you know, with that and with the climate change, the possibility of a tsunami or anything else coming here, I'm kind of wondering why it doesn't seem like the ideal location, you know, if something did happen. So if you can address the topic of smaller facilities versus the larger one, appreciate it.
Sure. Yeah, right on.
David or Mark.
Yeah, I'll start with this one. And if you guys have anything to opine on, let me know. So, you know, the size is looked at. I mean, that's just a part of the evaluation. And largely that's tied to the transmission component, right? So what's available on the physics side, on the lines, on the substation, what's the usable space on the property? That's the 24 acres. So that 600 number was derived from that need. So it checked all those boxes. So that's just how it's starting from the roots up, right? So then that's when we work with the city and the local participating, you know, through the CEQA process, the ultimate design that needs to get approved, you know, through the fire department and police department, the appropriate size and all those things. It's all factored in throughout. So regarding spreading them out, again, it's not necessarily a mutually exclusive situation right now with the need on the grid. So, you know, more projects are needed along the way. So that's where these substations are critical as far as the siting them, right? So that's where that number came from, if that makes sense.
Take a question over on the far section up here in the front. Yeah.
My questions are simple, so I'm going to ask two really quickly. One is regarding the Moss Landing site. The issue that happened was water related. And can you tell me how that differs from the Tesla, where there actually was a fire, is my understanding? And then my second question is that our Morro Bay Fire Department is not equipped to respond, I'm quite sure, to adequately to a dangerous situation such as could occur at, I mean, all the things that we've brought up. So damaging to the whole city. So what types of improvements to response by our fire department would we need, and how would Vistra support those improvements?
That's a good question. David or Mark?
Yeah, thank you. Great question. The incidents at Elkhorn and at Moss Landing were actually very similar. Neither one of them was a thermal runaway of a battery. They both involved water. So, you know, ours was the hose connections popped open and just sprayed water all over these electrical connections, which led to arcing and that type of thing. And then, you know, we shut the whole system down and we had to repair just due to water damage. The Elkhorn, the Tesla mega packs that were damaged there was due to water intrusion from rain, just got down in. And I don't know the specific technical details, but, you know, kind of anecdotally talking to people around, you know, that's what happened. The water got in and basically shorted it out, similar to, you know, the Moss Landing. That one resulted in a fire. Ours did not. You know, we had plenty of water to put the fire out, you know, whereas the Tesla fire response is different than Moss Landing. Whereas Moss Landing, we have water that we spray in. That's what we use. The Tesla is they let it burn. And they space the containers far enough apart so that if it does burn, it doesn't get to any of the other containers around them. Does that help? Okay.
Okay.
And then I'll let David talk about the fire department type.
Oh, hold on.
I'll share just a couple of things with our experience at Moss Landing and Chief Mendoza there, the fire chief. He was where Chief McCrane is currently about 4 years ago when we started talking with him. Right. So it's what's going on? What is this proposal? So that's part of what Vistra's committed to is working with the fire departments. And Chief Mendoza can testify that we have been with him every step of the way from early design through all the different selections, through training, equipment evaluation. And one interesting thing that he's pointed out is that the fire departments are already trained for all types of fires. What the batteries bring is not a different type of fire that they don't experience. It's understanding what's going on at that fire. So as far as equipment goes, he was blunt in just saying there wasn't additional equipment needed necessarily or different equipment needed. I'll speak up there. Staffing was one of the concerns, right? And that's where Vistra 100% partnered with him to make sure he's set up with everything he needs to run his crew, right? And we would do the same thing here with Chief McCrane. So we'll talk with Chief McCrane, and we're listening to the needs of the fire department.
Well,
for sure.
And David, I think you can get into in Moss Landing, David said there was a staffing issue, right?
Yeah.
What we did, and I don't want to get into all the details, but we put forth money unilaterally to fund that until the valuations rose because of the investment, which you just saw, the capital investment, and those tax payments went up over a period of years, so that then the fire department had the adequate funding through the tax mechanism to fund the additional positions. So yes, we were assisting directly.
So staffing, equipment, we'll work with the fire department.
Yeah, and Morro Bay Fire Department is going to be different. They all are. That's why we try to look at each unique situation. But yes, we absolutely do assist with that and any related equipment that is necessary as well.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah. Okay. Over here in this section, Homer. Hold on. Let the microphone get up to you.
You mentioned sales tax earlier.
Yes.
Will the batteries, obviously, you're going to purchase those. Will those be delivered to Morro Bay directly so that Morro Bay could take advantage of the sales tax?
Yes. Yes.
Will that include the other, all the other materials that you need to purchase?
Yes. David got into it kind of on a high level, but I can tell you our Vistra tax folks have looked at what the capital costs would be along with development. And it's between that sales tax would be between $7 and $8 million. And it would be for the batteries and it would be for the materials.
Earlier you mentioned the whole project is $900 million, approximately. How much of that is going to be labor? And who will provide that labor?
Can't tell you how much the labor is. We know that you got $900 million, then you have the cost of the batteries plus materials. That is not at $900 million. The rest is the labor part of it. And you want to address?
The majority of that is equipment. So the majority of the 900, the labor, I don't know a percentage, but it's just a smaller percentage. The bulk of that expense is equipment.
And workers, I think he was asked about workers, labor.
And then who provides? So what Vistra's traditionally done is hired an EPC contractor to, it's like a full turnkey type situation where they complete the E stands for engineering, P procurement, and C construction. So all those pieces is kind of one shop, and there's a handful of trusted partners that we utilize historically, but we evaluate that on an ongoing basis. So at this point, we have not selected who that's going to be, but it will be an EPC contractor. Right? Yes. Yes, there will be a PLA for the project.
We're going to go here in the middle. You want to try way in the back?
I have not looked at the EIR, and this may be a naive question, but we keep hearing about rising sea levels and tsunamis. What would be the effect if there was an influx of seawater onto this facility?
I do urge you to read in the draft EIR under the hazards and hazardous materials section. It's 411 pages. It's great bedtime reading, as a gentleman alluded to the other day, a moment ago. But you can scroll through it pretty quickly and find that section. And it does address tsunamis and flooding. The actual project site is in a 500-year flood area, okay? So very low probability. The rest of the site's in a 100-year flood area. It also points out that the entire area is in the a tsunami hazard area or hazard zone, but the project is surrounded by a 33-foot berm, and the draft EIR also points out that it would be minimal risk because there is the harbor, Morro Rock, the sand spit, which act as somewhat as natural barriers as well. So it does address that, and that it is considered less than significant with mitigation. Now, you ask about what would that mean as far as the structures? If you look at, say, the containers or the large buildings, each will be secured by pilings that are down about 70 feet into bedrock. So they are secure. The containers actually are welded. They're welded to the actual pilings, or if they're a concrete pad, then they can be secured that way as well. So they're not going to floating out there. Anything you want to add?
I will add that seawater is what we use to kill battery cells. So when we have a defective cell at Moss Landing, you know, as you can imagine, again, 250,000 of them, you know, nothing's perfect as far as, you know, it might not work as well. So the manufacturer wants them back. So because they do an inspection, an actual destructive test, and cut it open. We call it an autopsy, where they cut the cell open if it's defective, and they report that back to us to make sure we understand what happened. But what we do before we ship them is put them in seawater, and that kills the cell. So if they covered it up, the batteries will die.
Okay, let's take a question over here on the far left. On the end there you go.
So I don't remember the actual numbers, but I know Moss Landing started off at, I don't know, a much smaller amount of batteries than it is now. I think we've just gone to what, 700 and some odd whatevers. So my question is, right now Morro Bay is slated to be 600. Do you foresee expanding beyond the 600 in the future? Will there be a phase two or three or four?
Great question. No, there's not. This would be it. And that's where, when we talk about siting the 24-acre parcel, that's kind of utilizing that space. So there would be no more expansion.
And my second question, on because I have not been out to that power plant, you talk about the 33-foot tall berm. Is that totally around the entire site, or is it like U-shape? Are you actually bringing your containers and equipment up and over that 33 berm and dropping them in there?
Yeah, good question. So the berm is encompassed on all sides except for small openings. And then during construction, you know, there's openings created to do the equipment back and forth, and then where necessary, rebuild the berm appropriately. So that's generally the method there. Correct.
Okay, let's come back over here. You had your hand up. Yeah, go ahead. Hold on. We're coming to you.
So Back to the saltwater intrusion to lithium ion batteries. The U.S. Coast Guard has multiple warnings and alerts and protocols because of the danger of saltwater intrusion into that they make lithium ion batteries combustible. And in my own research, I found lots and lots of articles about that. There was one describing the Felicity Ace, a car carrier ship off the coast of Portugal in February of 22. It had almost 4,000 luxury vehicles, and many of them had lithium ion batteries. They believe it was a Porsche lithium ion battery that caught fire first, but it spread to many other vehicles. They evacuated the crew of 22 and pulled up another ship next to it, hosed it down for 2 weeks. They said it just it keeps reigniting itself. This is what happens with lithium ion batteries. And they couldn't put the fire out, and the ship sank. And if you look at the issue in Florida after the hurricanes there, Hurricane Ian and another one, many Teslas and other electric vehicles were flooded. And then a week later, the water's dried up, but the salt is there, which creates a greater conductivity. And the car would just blow up. And sometimes they were in garages and they burned down the whole house. So I'm extremely concerned when I think about the fact that we're in a flood and tsunami zone. And you just mentioned water getting in and causing problems. It doesn't take salt water, but I think salt water makes it much, much worse. We have a situation where these batteries will be here for 20 years, maybe. And there's, you know, the recent budget requests talked about there's accelerating flooding events. Flooding and sea level rise are both problems. We have a creek that floods on one side. It can flood from either direction. We have the hills that get the rain and bring it down to Main Street. We could have any number of water intrusion events from freshwater or definitely salt water over the next 20 years. And it seems to me that we're not talking about one. I mean, a worst case scenario is multiple of these containers blow up and we can't get any help. It could be an ecological disaster and a humanitarian disaster.
Okay, here. Well, let me take the flooding question real quick. There's the data in the draft EIR that shows that the project site's in a 500-year flood area, right? Outside of that is 100 years. There's a tsunami flood zone as well. That is what the science is showing that has been studied, right? If you have contravening information or other credible information that you can pull up from other studies, we'd like to see that. No, we'd like to see that and make, you know, get another set of eyes on it. And okay, now the technology between EVs and what we're doing is a lot different. And I'll let David or Mark address.
Yeah, I'll start, Mark, and if you got anything. So you know, just kind of what Mark was talking about, humidity is a very key thing that we also measure at our facilities too, because of the water, right? So when a battery gets wet, the battery is effectively ruined. We would not put it back in service, period. Like if it gets wet for any reason, it would not, the humidity alarm would go off and it would disconnect itself and alert us. It would not go back in service immediately at all. It would then be inspected in a robust program to understand that it's not compromised in any way, shape, or form. So, and that goes with any level of water intrusion, right? So engineering codes and standards and what's studied ahead of time, like what we're in the process of, there's engineering elements you can employ at the site to minimize any type of water intrusion to the battery itself, foundation elevations, all sorts of different things, right? But what I'm talking about is if it happens to get wet, it's broke to us and it's removed, right? And then the manufacturer needs to tell us if it's suitable or not, and likely not, right? And then we'll replace it with a properly operating one. That's our process. Mark, was there anything to add on top of that too?
Yeah, during construction of Moss 350, you know, it was, you know, the atmospheric rivers and all that we had last year. And as David mentioned, the manufacturers have zero tolerance for liquid on the battery. So we literally condemned over 100 battery modules because of drops of water. Maybe a door was opened or, you know, during a storm and, you know, the manufacturer during inspection would see water in it. We had to pull it out. So they're very strict about, you know, using batteries that have been exposed to any water at all.
Let me, in fairness, to the folks who had sent in some questions via the website to address a couple of them, and then we'll get on up here in the front row. I know you've had your hand up, so up here in the front row, or the second row, actually. This one comes from Don Maruska. And Don asks, I recall a public meeting with the California Department of Toxic Substances Control in Bistra, in which the DTSC staff member responded to a question about the extent of pollution on the proposed BEST site. He opined that the pollution was in the surface layer and probably could be removed in two dump truck loads. This would enable the site to be physically able to be used for the visitor serving purposes for which the rest of the power plant site is zoned. Of course, the PG&E land use restrictions would need to be resolved as well. So Don asked two questions. One, since the proposed BEST site could be used for other purposes than industrial, what exploration has Vistra made about the other potential uses of the site? I think we've addressed that. We believe this is the BEST site. We believe this is how the site could be used for battery storage, repurposing the site at Vistra's expense, taking down the power building and the stacks, and then proceeding with a master plan. Don's second question was, how might the proposed BEST site and the power plant site overall be developed without the BEST project that would result in removal of the turbine building and stacks? To that, the draft EIR has on the table the only viable, realistic plan that repurposes the site for the future. Again, takes down the stacks and the power building at Vistra's expense, and then provides for a master plan for the future. There is no other plan out there. This facility has been retired for 10 years. There have been lots of ideas, but no developer has stepped up with a viable plan and a financing plan, importantly, as well. And even if Vistra were to go in and remediate the soil and so forth, you still have the PG&E deed restrictions. Now, regarding these questions that have been made about hauling away soil, there were groundwater samples that were taken at that site beginning in 1984. This has been going on for, 30-some years. In 1998, PG&E sold the plant to Duke. And at that time, DTSC declared publicly that PG&E is responsible for all environmental liability up until 1998. In 2006, there was a corrective action consent agreement that was agreed upon by PG&E and DTSC to examine what remediation of any pollution at the site should be undertaken, what actions need to be taken. There were numerous groundwater samples that were taken from 22 groundwater wells and also soil samples over time. Fast forward through the public input from DTSC and the revised statement of basis was that in 2022, DTSC said that the tank farm area, essentially, is one in which there is a land use covenant that will be placed on there because of a total hydrocarbons that are in the soil, restricting the site to industrial and commercial uses. The rest of the site, except for the power building, because there's been no sampling there because the building remains, the rest of the site has been released without action. So the state has decided what has needed to be done at the site regarding the pollution that was of concern back in the 90s and early 2000s. One more question here. Has Vistra considered other proven large-scale energy storage technologies, such as redox flow batteries, that do not need lithium in designing their energy storage facilities? Thanks to Rusty Moore for the question. David.
Yeah, I'll jump on that one too. So we have a whole team inside our organization that monitors technology. So that's when we say best available technology, that's what we mean. So it's all being considered, it's all being looked at. The proposals for the lithium ion, right? Because that is the current best available technology. So as we go and as we go through the process, that is an evaluation, certainly, right?
Okay, now go ahead.
Ignored me for a half hour. I have 536 questions.
I'm sorry, what?
So you want me to repeat that?
I couldn't hear everything you said. Go ahead.
So First, I want to say that I personally, as a person who grew up here in Morro Bay, am assaulted by a large corporation that is so successful. I'm glad for your corporation. Will come to my little city and want to plant a toxic bomb in the midst of it, because that's how I view this. It's right by my house, too, and I really didn't want to move, but we will, and I'm hoping our value, our home value, won't go down. So, Mr. Yeager, you spoke about the damage that the fumes can cause or can lead to a further problem of fires or thermal runaway or whatever. And so you really can't have those all around the batteries, right?
Have the what? I'm sorry. What's around the batteries?
Any of the toxic fumes.
Oh, the fumes.
Okay, those can't stay in your little area, right? They really need to go out.
Yeah, so there's certain ones, and the toxicity is a different discussion, but there's flammable type of fumes that are released that need to be dispersed, correct?
Okay.
Is that what you're saying? Did I answer that?
Assume, okay. Just because I'm not a scientist, and by the way, Sherry, thank you for your information. It was all wonderful. I'm going to assume that if these fumes aren't good enough for the batteries, they're not good enough for us.
Sure.
You're wanting to release them. And then you haven't really talked about all of that releasing of these toxic things. Sherry did a little bit.
Yeah.
But I feel like you talked about checking off all of these boxes. But when did you check off the box of, we're going to go around to the neighborhoods and ask people, do they want the money or do they want the clean air and the safety of knowing there's not a toxic bomb in their backyard that will be a target? It will, just like Diablo. We already have Diablo. We live with Diablo. Diablo has all of the safety precautions for the best that they can protect that toxic bomb. In place, what are your safety precautions? What are you going to have? What kind of radar, what kind of national defense will you have that's searching the air, searching all around for any little drone that's going to come down and do something, whatever? What do you have in place?
No, thank you for your concern, and I truly hope you don't feel assaulted by, you know, what I'm bringing. Okay, so I'll answer your question. Okay, so we're following. Okay, so I'll let me circle back to that. Let me answer your first question. Okay, it's a good one. So we're going to work with the city. So all the decisions, this isn't a Vistra decision that gets made. It needs to partner, and that's why we're going through the CEQA process, right? The information gathered in this process is used to make decisions from. So that's where we are. We're gathering all the information. We're getting all the studies done that can possibly be done, including what Dr. Lubicki's presented, right? And we want to present that to all the decision makers locally, right? And that's what we're doing. So we're trying to team up with you and with the city as we work through this process. And what I want to do is just share the information, your opinion on you know, whether you want it or not, that's yours. And I respect you and I respect your opinion. Truly, truly do. So, but what I want to do is present the information. That's what we're doing.
You good, David? Okay.
Okay.
The gentleman over here who had two questions earlier, and I said, we'll get back to them. There you go.
Thank you for coming back to me.
You bet.
David, I'm sorry, but when you implied that salt water was safe for batteries, when you said you doused them, I know you didn't mean to do that, but that's what you implied. Salt water is not safe for batteries. You're dousing defective batteries to neutralize them and short them out. Okay, that's what you meant to say. All right, the second thing is, have you measured EMF emissions to the employees that are working around these inverters, because they're high powered they're putting off emissions. Have you measured that? I'm just curious. As secondly, in your EIS, you said there was no adverse effect on scenic vista. That's not a serious response. It is an adverse effect. It's a horrible effect.
Can you repeat that? There's not a serious on
your,
what?
Your OCA, I understand you did all those studies. And, you know, I've run those models myself in the past when I worked for an oil company. And it's just not credible. You know, you look at what happened at Moss Landing, you look at what happened down by San Diego, you're saying that, I'm sure they ran those studies too. You're saying that, oh, the risk is so low, but yet the battery fires are happening. So it's hard for us to really swallow it and accept it. It's not going to happen here. I don't believe it. Sorry.
Okay, let's come over here. Let's try and get in the back. Right. Yes. Just go ahead and stand up. Hold on. Let Patrick put the microphone get to you.
One thing that you said, David, is that Vistra has been in operation for 140 years, and I was sitting here thinking, wow, that's incredible. So I looked it up, and this is a quote from your website. Vistra was established in Hong Kong in 1986 as OIL and quickly grew. That's from your own website, but if it's wrong, maybe you ought to fix that. To assume the wind is going to blow one direction is another thing that makes me laugh. We talk about evacuation when there's a fire, not if, but when there's a fire. The people who at the Rock, if you're ever here on the weekend, they will be driving toward the fire. The people at the kayak will be going towards the fire. The otters are not going to know to evacuate or to hold their breath. When you explain supply and demand of energy, you assume we don't already know that. I think this group is pretty intelligent. And all of us who have lived in California their entire life know that we need to conserve and save energy. So I have two questions. One question is, would you want to own a home next door to a BESS? And are you going to carry our insurance when the companies in California stop providing it? And did you know that the Coastal Act number 30253 says new development shall minimize risk to life and property from areas of high geologic and flood activity and protect special communities with unique characteristics and popular visitor destination points for recreation? Why does your project not meet these requirements?
Let me take the first. There are other companies named Vistra. Our company goes back 140 years through its predecessor company since it was founded in Texas. So the company has been around for 140 years. We don't have any affiliation with any start in Hong Kong, was it? I can't see that, but the company didn't start. Hold on.
So the living next door part, I wouldn't have hesitation, sincerely. From an engineer, the technical perspective, I understand what's there. How it would react. I live in Santa Cruz. Yeah, no, I understand. So I don't know that answer because I've not talked with an insurance company in that regard. So I can't answer that part. So was there another question?
I think that was it.
So that determination's made by the Coastal Commission, right?
Caroline, over here. You're good.
There we go. You guys talk about a safety and an environmental impact report or any way to mitigate loss to human life. And one of the poisons that comes out of a battery blowing up or catching fire or doing whatever it's going to do, going to the next ones, which they have done, is hydrogen cyanide. You don't have that listed up there and telling people that that's poison, deadly poison. And we have the winds that will carry it to all of the elders that are in the area and the children that are right there at the school. Hydrogen fluoride, yes. Carbon dioxide, all of it is hazardous. And you name it in parts per million. What does the parts per billion do? What is that on a daily basis that it's flowing through this area?
So let me talk really quickly about hydrogen fluoride and hydrogen cyanide. So remember, and I'm sorry, I was talking really quickly to make sure that we could get to your questions. But I did say that this presentation talks about hydrogen fluoride, but in the report, I analyzed other chemicals, and I did not say including hydrogen cyanide, but in fact, it includes hydrogen cyanide. So that chemical was in there as well. Part of the reason we do hydrogen fluoride here and not hydrogen cyanide is lots of fires of plastics release hydrogen cyanide, just general plastics. But the hydrogen fluoride is specific to the battery. But the report included hydrogen cyanide. So that's just super important. And I want to make sure that you're aware that we did evaluate it. So again, this report talks about what the risks are for a fire. And that those risks from hydrogen cyanide are below the threshold of concern for what we consider a worst case combustion event. Exactly. And then you said something else. I don't know if I remember it.
Ma'am, was there a third part of your or second question?
Oh. So okay. That's important too. Do you want to do that?
Sure. Okay. Sure.
Some of the mitigation and design efforts that go in space out the batteries appropriately to where they will not train beyond a certain point, right? There's only a certain amount clustered close enough that they would then kind of move together. That's the thermal runaway that you're talking about, right? So if one catches, then the next, similar to the boat discussion with so many of the EVs stacked next to each other, right? Is that what you're referencing? Uh-huh. Sure. So like take the enclosure alternative as an example. Envision it as like on the boat, like with the Teslas, if one had a problem, it then spread the heat to the next one that then had a problem that spread it to heat. So imagine if those Teslas were spread out from one another to where there's space to where it wouldn't spread either way. That's an example of a design tactic or, mitigation that's employed to where the enclosure is the most batteries at one point that is close enough to where if there is a thermal runaway event, it could potentially spread to one another, right? So outside of that container or enclosure, there's metal layers as well as physical space that would prevent any type of movement from a container to another container. So that's considered and heavily understood to where the design is trying to mitigate against from that, right?
And the damage that they cause in the areas that they spread to, I have.
You're talking about a battery energy storage system? Okay. Yes. So what vendors do is they actually go through the UL testing too on their products. And what UL does is whatever product they're proposing, this is from the vendor that they're trying to sell, they intentionally start a thermal runaway event in their product. They then step back and watch what happens, right? So this is all done before any selections made, and that's called UL testing, right? And code is requiring that all batteries be UL tested and UL listed, and they know the results, and we communicate that to the fire department. So that helps us understand in that environment, say you have a container or several batteries stacked next to each other, they will intentionally make one go into thermal runaway and test it and see what happens, right? And that result is very important for all the design factors that we do. If there's additional mitigations, like the water injection system, as an example, would that support and enhance, the heat from spreading? Those are all things that get considered through this.
Let's move over here to the far section. We've gone through about three. Are there any questions over in the far section? Okay, let's come back over here. Oh, council member? I know, but we'll get to her. We're going to be trying to get to everyone. Council member Landrum has a question. I'm going to yield the floor to her.
Hi. I actually have a couple questions.
All right.
One regarding the sales tax is there any limitation to, is it on anything you buy for the plant, or is there criteria like country of origin or anything like that? Does it have to be just made in America or?
It is on the right now we've gone through kind of high level analysis, council member, and we're looking at what the batteries would be and then the materials as well. So the sales tax comes in at about $7 to $8 million. I don't think there's any distinction on from where it is coming. We haven't even picked a vendor, as David has mentioned many times, but we do have metrics we try to look at on what the cost would be, and then apply what valuations would be as well. They're estimates, right? And so that's what we would have to apply, but it gives what we hope is some sense of what the capital investment extrapolates to as far as the sales taxes and then longer term, the property taxes.
Okay. And then I'm drawing a blank. David,
yes.
What is the capacity of the water storage in case of a fire?
So that's going to be sized according to the need, right? So right now, without the vendor selection and the exact known amount, but we don't know, but it will be calculated and there will be an appropriate amount on site to fit that exact need.
And that's underground? That's
No, it would be above ground water tank, similar to what's out there right now.
Okay. And let's see, I could help with the woman that asked about the fire department because I took notes.
Yeah.
I toured the Moss Landing site and got to hear the fire chief speaking, and they had a fire. Their force was 22 people, I think, and now it's 30. So just to give you that information. Let's see. And also to the woman that was asking about when your company formed, I looked it up too. And so it looks like somewhere around 2016, after your at Texas Competitive Electric Holdings emerged from bankruptcy. And since you're asking to have a partnership with the city of Morro Bay, how can we guarantee that that something like that won't happen, like when it's time for you to close the site and clean it up and,
That's a good question.
That's a good question because every company goes through iterations, especially one that's been around as long as we have. So there have been different owners, if you will. What you referred to was when the company was taken private in about 2008. The holding company had a debt issue, Energy Future Holdings at the time. But the operating companies were very, very healthy and competitive for generation and also retail electric providers, since Texas, like California, is a competitive market state. So the holding company had to go into bankruptcy. The operating companies emerged in 2016 as publicly held, traded on the New York Stock Exchange under VST, and at that time took on a new name, new management, new owners, and was called Vistra. But it's a continuation, as we say, of predecessor companies that had been established, over decades, mostly in Texas. Then in 2018, we acquired Dynegy and the plant site here in an acquisition, and we've continued to grow since then. So to your question of longevity, there will be a commitment and there would have to be some financial backing as well for the decommissioning. And I'll yield to Mark or David, because we are building sites in Illinois and Texas, and they're asking the same questions, and they're good questions about what are you going to do after another 40 years to make sure that the site is decommissioned, the equipment is taken down, and that it's returned to the condition as was found. So
yeah,
they both have had to deal with
from an accounting standpoint, you know, that's all factored in and carried on the book. So that is that commitment to repair the site to where it was, and recycle, you know, remove facilities and all those pieces too. So that is a financial commitment inside our organization that we carry all that too. Mark, was there anything there on that? So that is a guarantee.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes.
Where's our microphone? Okay.
How many BESS plants do you have and how long have you operated them? Like, what's your experience?
See, the overall, so from 2018 was when our first BESS plant was in our portfolio. Mark, I might pass it to Mark. He's responsible for running all of them, so he'll let you know.
Yeah, what a tough question, you know, so I'm sitting here trying to count. You know, obviously Moss Landing, you know, we have the best facility at De Cordova, and then we have an Upton facility. So that's what the current lineup now.
Yeah.
I would say it's a mix. Upton is in West Texas, so it's you know, it's desert and pretty sparse out there. You know, Moss Landing, I'm sure you're familiar with it. You've been up there and seen that, you know. And De Cordova is in a community.
The NOP that was delivered or issued by the city in June of 2022 established what the chronology would be, and that is the batteries would be built first. After that, and I believe the draft EIR says within 6 months, then Vistra is committed to demolish the power building and the stacks to make way for the master plan. And I believe the demolition would take about 2 years. So that's the chronology that is set out by the NOP. When we have retired sites that we really don't have any further use for, we will demolish them, but we're not a utility. We don't have a captive rate base. It comes off our balance sheet as a cost, but we try to recoup that cost through what the scrap market is. For instance, Units 6 and 7 and Moss Landing, where you were, and we saw that the steel superstructure was down there tearing it up. That gets sold off for scrap, so we try to offset those costs for that. So we wouldn't just unilaterally go out and demolish a plant when it's been decommissioned and it's no longer being used. We're patient to hold on to it until the timing is right to do it financially. Are you good? Okay, now we'll get over to you. Talk.
First of all, I just want to say thank you for at least acknowledging that the if there were a fire and gas release, wouldn't stay on site, because that is what they said last month at this meeting. And I argued that point since we were talking about the winds. When I was on my way to Capitola, the Moss Landing fire was going on, or the event, and they rerouted traffic. I understand that they put the community on lockdown. So if it wasn't a fire, you know, why did they go to those precautions? One of the largest fires I've read recently was in Arizona, lasted 11 days, 6 million gallons of water to put it out or keep it cool, however you want to say that. The more I investigate these BESS is popping up all over our state, let alone our country. You have people like us, and I would say maybe 95% in this room we don't want the battery. They're fighting against it. Vacaville just put a moratorium up there on that one. The county, their county supervisors did, I understand, and their city council is going to be voting on it. But these energy companies are doing this. So we're not alone, people. We're not fighting this battle alone. We're fighting our battle, yes, but we're not fighting alone. So a friend of mine could not be here tonight, and she wanted to ask me to ask this question. She said, it may be premature, but I've been wondering about the noise from the batteries. 31 hertz to 500 hertz, low bass sound. Here's what people in other towns are saying about that. Because low frequencies travel through everything, everyone within a quarter of a mile will hear a constant hum in their house, even if all your windows and doors are closed all day, every day. So it could be premature to answer that, but do you have an answer or close to
yes, anything? It's actually in the draft EIR under noise. If you would read that, it will show that Rincon hired a special consultant to examine noise for an operating system, which found that in the case of Morro Bay, it would be at 43 dBA decibels up to the RV park offsite. To the south, the closest residential area would be 39 dBA. The city ordinance is noises no louder than 60 dBA. By comparison, I believe at night, a suburban quiet street usually is at about 50. So the draft EIR did examine operational noise, which includes the inverters, and the council member and others, your chair of the planning commission, were all Moss Landing on a tour just a few weeks ago, and they were all around this equipment. Yeah, up close, does it make a hum because of fans and so forth? Yes, but we're talking about distances away in residences. The draft EIR addressed that and found that there was no significant. We'll take about one or two more questions,
Brad,
and we're going to have to
wrap. I want to talk about the shelter in place that you were talking about on Highway 1. I think that's a very important thing real quick. Was that the reason why that was put in place? And Chief Mendoza, and this is public too, there's been case studies for this. They did not have what Dr. Lubicki had produced. So the responders to that incident did not know what was happening as far as radius, what chemicals, they didn't know. So out of an abundance of caution, they had to make that call. And I get that. I think we all get that, right? So that's why we do these offsite consequence analysis. It's very important. We did these at our Moss Landing facilities, like on our own. This is pre any type of legislation or law, to where any response on our side never resulted in an offsite consequence or a shelter in place or any of those things. That ultimate decision is with the local authorities, right? And the fire department, sheriff's office, that group makes that call. So that's why we produce all this information to those people that make decisions. And that's where the planning comes in. It shouldn't be a mystery and all those pieces because of this effort here. So I just wanted to make that clarification. They did not have this information when they made that call. Okay.
Okay. Our last question of the night, sir.
Oh, thank you. My arm was getting really tired.
Trying to get to everybody as far as we can.
I appreciate that.
Sure.
I have two questions, if I may, and I'll ask the first, get it answered, and then I'll ask the second.
Sure.
If that works. Yes, we see all of these signs here tonight, yes, on A24, referring to the ballot measure that's going to be on the ballot in November. And you, David, at the beginning, you showed your timeline for how this is going to proceed. And you showed that you expected to go to the city council and get approval by the end of this year, given that November is at the end of this year. You're expecting to move it sometime before the end of your approval. How does this ballot measure play into your timing and your plans?
Yeah, good question, Brad. I'll start sure. with that one. So, you know, we're just focused on the project, you know, sincerely. So when the draft EIR gets made public, there are statutory clocks that start. So that timeline is the process just kind of playing out on its own. That's where it's derived. Vistra's not driving that process. It's more or less the CEQA statutory process in action. So that timeline kind of coincides with that. It's not necessarily a decision on Vistra's part.
Another good time to remind people that the comment period is open until May 28th on the draft EIR. Yeah, it does have deadlines set yes. out. So
okay. And speaking of speaking of the EIR, my second question is relative to that. We're going through that process right now, and as we read through the EIR, and then from what I hear tonight, and what I have heard in previous public announcements, is that we have a project here that we're asked to comment on to consider the impacts and the mitigation strategies and everything else. The problem is, I don't know what project we're talking about. Because I don't know, are we talking about the three buildings? Are we talking about the 174 containers? I don't know what I'm supposed to comment on here. And the preferred alternative, environmental alternative, is alternative three, which says that you're going to build a battery plant, but you're not going to take down the building or the stacks. And then I hear also that we're not sure even what chemicals are going to be used, what batteries are going to be used. All of these things about the supplies and material equipment are all still unknown. And yet we're asked to provide our comments and our thoughts and our mitigation strategies on a project that really is ill-defined, unknown, unsure, uncertain. How do you expect us as citizens to deal with your project, analyze your project, and comment on it when you can't even tell us what you're going to be building?
Well, a couple of things. There's the draft EIR project, the draft EIR process, which is separate for commenting on environmental impacts, and you can see the categories covered in the draft EIR. And then there is the other aspect in which Vistra is holding community meetings like this, and we plan to hold another in May. We're looking at dates in which we are getting input, but importantly, presenting information that is available to everybody now on our website, all these reports, and making our people available for questions about the project. So this has to go through a very methodical process by which we have to go through draft EIR, get approval from the lead agency, which is the city of Morro Bay. It's got to go to the Coastal Commission. And then, you know, when David and Mark swing into action about, okay, what are we actually going to buy as far as vendors, that is still a couple of years or more away, perhaps. So that is why we can't answer that exactly. But we can give you the best information that we have to date on there have been questions about, well, what kind of batteries would you put in? We don't know yet. We just don't know yet.
And I might add real quick too that this is the state mandated process, so we're following that. In fact, we're actually going above and beyond the OCA that Dr. Labicki. That's not required. We're listening. We're hearing the concern, so we wanted to go above and beyond to provide that type of information as this process is going out. So we're following that process. And again, we're committed to hearing. We're hearing the concerns. We're trying to do everything we can to produce some information.
Yeah, the. I don't believe that's our call. The city released the draft EIR. That's not Vistra's call.
Yeah, we don't have control when it was released.
And I know the EIR process, it's the city's consultant working very close to the applicant and the applicant's consultant to develop the EIR and to determine phases that it's going to be able to do and the timing on that. And the city is led by a consultant and by your consultant, so it works with the city. And if you knew you had this OCA coming out, within a matter of 9 days, I think it was later, could you have just suggested that we 9 days later, or 2 weeks later, or 3 weeks later, give time for the government?
Well, there's no correlation there, as you imply. And they're different. The draft EIR does not get into safety in a granular way, substantive way, like Dr. Labicki's report. Again, to David's point, this is not something Vistra had to do. We did it to try to release as much information about what the risks are for a maximum credible event on a fire like this. So as far as some kind of timing correlation, it's not there. The draft EIR is underway. It's been released. I urge you to make your comments by May 28th. That's all the time we have for tonight. Thank you very much. Hold on. Brett. The mayor has a question, and she has the floor. Okay. Comments. Yep.
Thank you. Just one really quick second. I'd like to remind everyone here this evening and listening at home that May 7th, Tuesday, the Planning Commission will be reviewing the draft EIR and will be available. All comments made that night will be submitted. So please make sure all of you here and all those of you listening at home attend. And you can also Zoom in. And then May 8th, the following night, Wednesday, same Vets Hall, the RINCON will be there along with the city doing a presentation on the general plan update report.
Thank you, Mayor, for the reminders. Okay.
On rule again, Morro Bay has 10,696. Moss Landing, as if you look up here in 2011, there were 232 people. If you scroll down to 222, there are 9. I can't believe that Moss Landing only has 9 people, but that's according to Google again.
Oh.
You cannot
a little bit of context there, and we're going to call a little bit of context. There are thousands of cars that go up and down Highway 1 and Dolan Road every single day. There's the Moss Landing Harbor District. There are multiple small businesses there that are, and there are homes to the north as well. So that's not quite, I would say it's not going to be an apples to apples, but it's not a dismissive one either. Thank you all for coming, and we stand adjourned.